question anywhere when I was present took that direction, as it sometimes naturally did, I tried not to hear. I mentally counted, repeated something that I knew, or went out of the room. I am conscious now that I often did these things when there can have been no danger of her being spoken of, but I did them in the dread I had of hearing anything that might lead to her betrayal, and to her betrayal through me. It matters little now how often I recalled the tones of my mother's voice, wondered whether I should ever hear it again, as I so longed to do, and thought how strange and desolate it was that it should be so new to me. It matters little that I watched for every public mention of my mother's name, that I passed and repassed the door of her house in town, loving it, but afraid to look at it, that I once sat in the theatre when my mother was there and saw me, and when we were so wide asunder before the great company of all degrees that any link or confidence between us seemed a dream. It is all over. My lot has been so blessed that I can relate little of myself which is not a story of goodness and generosity in others. I may well pass that little and go on. When we were settled at home again, Ada and I had many conversations with my guardian, of which Richard was the theme. My dear girl was deeply grieved that he should do their kind cousin so much wrong, but she was so faithful to Richard that she could not bear to blame him even for that. My guardian was assured of it, and never coupled his name with a word of reproof. "Rick is mistaken, my dear," he would say to her. "Well, well, we have all been mistaken over and over again. We must trust to you and time to set him right." We knew afterwards what we suspected then, that he did not trust to time until he had often tried to open Richard's eyes, that he had written to him, gone to him, talked with him, tried every gentle and persuasive art his kindness could devise. Our poor devoted Richard was deaf and blind to all. If he were wrong, he would make amends when the Chancery suit was over. If he were groping in the dark, he could not do better than do his utmost to clear away those clouds in which so much was confused and obscured. Suspicion and misunderstanding were the fault of the suit? Then let him work the suit out, and come through it to his right mind. This was his unvarying reply. Jarndyce and Jarndyce had obtained such possession of his whole nature that it was impossible to place any consideration before him which he did not, with a distorted kind of reason, make a new argument in favour of his doing what he did. "So that it is even more mischievous," said my guardian once to me, "to remonstrate with the poor dear fellow than to leave him alone." I took one of these opportunities of mentioning my doubts of Mr. Skimpole as a good adviser for Richard. "Adviser?" returned my guardian, laughing. "My dear, who would advise with Skimpole?"
"Encourager would perhaps have been a better word," said I.
"Encourager," returned my guardian again. "Who could be encouraged by Skimpole?"
"Not Richard?" I asked.
"No," he replied. "Such an unworldly, uncalculating, gossamer creature is a relief to him and an amusement. But as to advising or encouraging or occupying a serious station towards anybody or anything, it is simply not to be thought of in such a child as Skimpole."
"Pray, Cousin John," said Ada, who had just joined us and now looked over my shoulder, "what made him such a child?"
"What made him such a child?" inquired my guardian, rubbing his head a little at a loss.
"Yes, Cousin John."
"Why," he slowly replied, roughening his head more and more, "he is all sentiment and susceptibility and sensibility and imagination, and these qualities are not regulated in him somehow. I suppose the people who admired him for them in his youth attached too much importance to them and too little to any training that would have balanced and adjusted them, and so he became what he is. Eh?" said my guardian, stopping short and looking at us hopefully. "What do you think, you two?"
Ada, glancing at me, said she thought it was a pity he should be an expense to Richard.
"So it is, so it is," returned my guardian hurriedly. "That must not be. We must arrange that. I must prevent it. That will never do."
And I said I thought it was to be regretted that he had ever introduced Richard to Mr. Vholes for a present of £5.
"Did he?"
said my guardian, with a passing shade of vexation on his face.
"But there you have the man. There you have the man. There is nothing mercenary in that with him. He has no idea of the value of money. He introduces Rick, and then he is good friends with Mr. Vholes, and borrows £5 of him. He means nothing by it, and thinks nothing of it.
He told you himself, I'll be bound, my dear.
Oh, yes, said I.
Exactly, cried my guardian, quite triumphant. There you have the man. If he had meant any harm by it, or was conscious of any harm in it, he wouldn't tell it. He tells it as he does it, in mere simplicity. But you shall see him in his own home, and then you'll understand him better. We must pay a visit to Harold Skimpole, and caution him on these points. Lord bless you, my dears, an infant, an infant. In pursuance of this plan, we went into London on an early day and presented ourselves at Mr. Skimpole's door. He lived in a place called the Polygon, in Somers Town, where there were at that time a number of poor Spanish refugees walking about in cloaks, smoking little paper cigars. Whether he was a better tenant than one might have supposed, in consequence of his friend Somebody always paying his rent at last, or whether his inaptitude for business rendered it particularly difficult to turn him out, I don't know. But he had occupied the same house some years. It was in a state of dilapidation quite equal to our expectation. Two or three of the area railings were gone. The water butt was broken. The knocker was loose. The bell handle had been pulled off a long time, to judge from the rusty state of the wire, and dirty footprints on the steps were the only signs of its being inhabited. A slatternly, full-blown girl who seemed to be bursting out at the rents in her gown and the cracks in her shoes like an overripe berry answered our knock by opening the door a very little way and stopping up the gap with her figure. As she knew Mr. Jarndyce, indeed Ada and I both thought that she evidently associated him with the receipt of her wages, she immediately relented and allowed us to pass in. The lock of the door being in a disabled condition, she then applied herself to securing it with the chain, which was not in good action either, and said would we go upstairs. We went upstairs to the first floor, still seeing no other furniture than the dirty footprints. Mr. Jarndyce, without further ceremony, entered a room there, and we followed. It was dingy enough and not at all clean, but furnished with an odd kind of shabby luxury, with a large footstool, a sofa, and plenty of cushions, an easy chair and plenty of pillows, a piano, books, drawing materials, music, newspapers, and a few sketches and pictures. A broken pane of glass in one of the dirty windows was papered and wafered over, but there was a little plate of hothouse nectarines on the table, and there was another of grapes, and another of sponge cakes, and there was a bottle of light wine. Mr. Skimpole himself reclined upon the sofa in a dressing gown, drinking some fragrant coffee from an old china cup. It was then about midday, and looking at a collection of wallflowers in the balcony. He was not in the least disconcerted by our appearance, but rose and received us in his usual airy manner. "Here I am, you see," he said when we were seated, not without some difficulty, the greater part of the chairs being broken. "Here I am. This is my frugal breakfast. Some men want legs of beef and mutton for breakfast. I don't. Give me my peach, my cup of coffee, and my claret. I am content. I don't want them for themselves, but they remind me of the sun. There's nothing solar about legs of beef and mutton, mere animal satisfaction." "This is our friend's consulting room, or would be if he ever prescribed, his sanctum, his studio," said my guardian to us.
"Yes," said Mr. Skimpole, turning his bright face about, "this is the bird's cage. This is where the bird lives and sings. They pluck his feathers now and then and clip his wings, but he sings, he sings."
He handed us the grapes, repeating in his radiant way, "He sings, not an ambitious note, but still he sings."
"These are very fine," said my guardian. "A present?"
"No," he answered. "No, some amiable gardener sells them. His man wanted to know, when he brought them last evening, whether he should wait for the money. Really, my friend," I said, "I think not, if your time is of any value to you." I suppose it was, for he went away. My guardian looked at us with a smile, as though he asked us, "Is it possible to be worldly with this baby?"
"This is a day," said Mr. Skimpole, gaily taking a little claret in a tumbler, "that will ever be remembered here. We shall call it St. Clair and St. Summerson Day. You must see my daughters. I have a blue-eyed daughter who is my beauty daughter. I have a sentiment daughter, and I have a comedy daughter. You must see them all. They'll be enchanted."
He was going to summon them, when my guardian interposed and asked him to pause a moment, as he wished to say a word to him first.
"My dear Jarndyce," he cheerfully replied, going back to his sofa, "as many moments as you please. Time is no object here. We never know what o'clock it is, and we never care. Not the way to get on in life, you'll tell me, certainly, but we don't get on in life. We don't pretend to do it. My guardian looked at us again, plainly saying, "You hear him?" "Now, Harold," he began, "the word I have to say relates to Rick." "The dearest friend I have," returned Mr. Skimpole cordially. "I suppose he ought not to be my dearest friend, as he is not on terms with you, but he is, I can't help it. He is full of youthful poetry, and I love him. If you don't like it, I can't help it. I love him." The engaging frankness with which he made this declaration really had a disinterested appearance, and captivated my guardian, if not, for the moment, Ada too.
"You are welcome to love him as much as you like," returned Mr. Jarndyce. "But we must save his pocket, Harold."
"Oh," said Mr. Skimpole, "his pocket. Now you're coming to what I don't understand." Taking a little more claret and dipping one of the cakes in it, he shook his head and smiled at Ada and me with an ingenuous foreboding that he never could be made to understand.
"If you go with him here or there," said my guardian plainly, "you must not let him pay for both."
"My dear Jarndyce," returned Mr. Skimpole, his genial face irradiated by the comicality of this idea. "What am I to do? If he takes me anywhere, I must go. And how can I pay? I never have any money. If I had any money, I don't know anything about it. Suppose I say to a man, 'How much?' Suppose the man says to me, 7 and 6p. I know nothing about 7 and 6p. It is impossible for me to pursue the subject with any consideration for the man. I don't go about asking busy people what 7 and 6p is in Moorish, which I don't understand. Why should I go about asking them what 7 and 6p is in money, which I don't understand?"
"Well," said my guardian, by no means displeased with this artless reply, "if you come to any kind of journeying with Rick, you must borrow the money of me, and never breathing the least allusion to that circumstance, and leave the calculation to him."
"My dear Jarndyce," returned Mr. Skimpole, "I will do anything to give you pleasure, but it seems an idle form, a superstition. Besides, I give you my word, Miss Clare and my dear Miss Summerson, I thought Mr. Carstone was immensely rich. I thought he had only to make over something, or to sign a bond, or a draft, or a cheque, or a bill, or to put something on a file somewhere to bring down a shower of money."
"Indeed it is not so, sir," said Ada. "He is poor."
"No, really?" returned Mr. Skimpole, with his bright smile. "You surprise me."
"And not being the richer for trusting in a rotten reed," said my guardian, laying his hand emphatically on the sleeve of Mr. Skimpole's dressing gown. "Be you very careful not to encourage him in that reliance, Harold."
"My dear good friend," returned Mr. Skimpole, "and my dear Miss Summerson, and my dear Miss Clare, how can I do that? It's business, and I don't know business. It is he who encourages me. He emerges from great feats of business, presents the brightest prospects before me as their result, and calls upon me to admire them. And I do admire them, as bright prospects. But I know no more about them, and I tell him so."
The helpless kind of candour with which he presented this before us, the light-hearted manner in which he was amused by his innocence, the fantastic way in which he took himself under his own protection and argued about that curious person, combined with the delightful ease of everything he said exactly to make out my guardian's case. The more I saw of him, the more unlikely it seemed to me, when he was present, that he could design, conceal, or influence anything. And yet the less likely that appeared when he was not present, and the less agreeable it was to think of his having anything to do with anyone for whom I cared. Hearing that his examination, as he called it, was now over, Mr. Skimpole left the room with a radiant face to fetch his daughters. His sons had run away at various times, leaving my guardian quite delighted by the manner in which he had vindicated his childish character. He soon came back, bringing with him the three young ladies and Mrs. Skimpole, who had once been a beauty but was now a delicate, high-nosed invalid, suffering under a complication of disorders. "This," said Mr. Skimpole, "is my beauty daughter, Arethusa, plays and sings odds and ends like her father. This is my sentiment daughter, Laura, plays a little but don't sing. This is my comedy daughter, Kitty, sings a little but don't play. We all draw a little and compose a little, and none of us have any idea of time or money." Mrs. Skimpole sighed, I thought, as if she would have been glad to strike out this item in the family attainments. I also thought that she rather impressed her sigh upon my guardian, and that she took every opportunity of throwing in another.
"It is pleasant," said Mr. Skimpole, turning his sprightly eyes from one to the other of us. "And it is whimsically interesting to trace peculiarities in families. In this family we are all children, and I am the youngest." The daughters, who appeared to be very fond of him, were amused by this droll fact, particularly the comedy daughter. "My dears, it is true," said Mr. Skimpole, "is it not? So it is, and so it must be, because, like the dogs in the hymn, it is our nature to. Now, here is Miss Summerson, with a fine administrative capacity, and a knowledge of details perfectly surprising. It will sound very strange in Miss Summerson's ears, I dare say, that we know nothing about chops in this house, but we don't, not the least. We can't cook anything whatever. A needle and thread we don't know how to use. We admire the people who possess the practical wisdom we want, but we don't quarrel with them. Then why should they quarrel with us? Live and let live, we say to them. Live upon your practical wisdom, and let us live upon you." He laughed, but as usual seemed quite candid, and really to mean what he said. "We have sympathy, my roses," said Mr. Skimpole. "Sympathy for everything, have we not?"
"Oh, yes, papa,"
cried the three daughters. "In fact, that is our family department," said Mr. Skimpole. "In this hurly-burly of life we are capable of looking on and of being interested. And we do look on, and we are interested. What more can we do? Here is my beauty daughter, married these 3 years. Now, I dare say her marrying another child and having two more was all wrong in point of political economy, but it was very agreeable. We had our little festivities on those occasions and exchanged social ideas. She brought her young husband home one day, and they and their young fledglings have their nest upstairs. I dare say at some time or other sentiment and comedy will bring their husbands home and have their nests upstairs too. So we get on, we don't know how, but somehow." She looked very young indeed to be the mother of two children, and I could not help pitying both her and them. It was evident that the three daughters had grown up as they could, and had had just as little haphazard instruction as qualified them to be their father's playthings in his idlest hours. His pictorial tastes were consulted, I observed, in their respective styles of wearing their hair, the beauty daughter being in the classic manner, the sentiment daughter luxuriant and flowing, and the comedy daughter in the arch style, with a good deal of sprightly forehead and vivacious little curls dotted about the corners of her eyes. They were dressed to correspond, though in a most untidy and negligent way. Ada and I conversed with these young ladies, and found them wonderfully like their father. In the meanwhile, Mr. Jarndyce, who had been rubbing his head to a great extent, and hinted at a change in the wind, talked with Mrs. Skimpole in a corner where we could not help hearing the chink of money. Mr. Skimpole had previously volunteered to go home with us, and had withdrawn to dress himself for the purpose. "My roses," he said when he came back, "take care of Mama, she's poorly today. By going home with Mr. Jarndyce for a day or two, I shall hear the larks sing and preserve my amiability. It has been tried, you know, and would be tried again if I remained at home."
"That bad man," said the comedy daughter. "At the very time when he knew Papa was lying ill by his wallflowers, looking at the blue sky," Laura complained. "And the smell of hay was in the air," said Arethusa.
"It showed a want of poetry in the man," Mr. Skimpole assented, but with perfect good humour. "It was coarse. There was an absence of the finer touches of humanity in it. My daughters have taken great offence," he explained to us, "at an honest man."
"Not honest, Papa, impossible," they all three protested.
"At a rough kind of fellow, a sort of human hedgehog rolled up," said Mr. Skimpole, "who is a baker in this neighbourhood, and from whom we borrowed a couple of armchairs. We wanted a couple of armchairs, and we hadn't got them, and therefore, of course, we looked to a man who had got them, to lend them. Well, this morose person lent them, and we wore them out. When they were worn out, he wanted them back. He had them back. He was contented, you will say. Not at all. He objected to their being worn. I reasoned with him and pointed out his mistake. I said, 'Can you at your time of life be so headstrong, my friend, as to persist that an armchair is a thing to put upon a shelf and look at? That it is an object to contemplate, to survey from a distance, to consider from a point of sight. Don't you know that these armchairs were borrowed to be sat upon?' He was unreasonable and unpersuadable, and used intemperate language. Being as patient as I am at this minute, I addressed another appeal to him. I said, 'Now, my good man, however our business capacities may vary, we are all children of one great mother, Nature. On this blooming summer morning here you see me. I was on the sofa, with flowers before me, fruit upon the table, the cloudless sky above me, the air full of fragrance, contemplating nature. I entreat you, by our common brotherhood, not to interpose between me and a subject so sublime, the absurd figure of an angry baker.
But he did,
said Mr. Skimpole, raising his laughing eyes in playful astonishment. He did interpose that ridiculous figure, and he does, and he will again. And therefore I am very glad to get out of his way, and to go home with my friend Jarndyce. It seemed to escape his consideration that Mrs. Skimpole and the daughters remained behind to encounter the baker, but this was so old a story to all of them that it had become a matter of course. He took leave of his family with a tenderness as airy and graceful as any other aspect in which he showed himself, and rode away with us in perfect harmony of mind. We had an opportunity of seeing through some open doors as we went downstairs that his own apartment was a palace to the rest of the house. I could have no anticipation, and I had none, that something very startling to me at the moment, and ever memorable to me in what ensued from it, was to happen before this day was out. Our guest was in such spirits on the way home that I could do nothing but listen to him and wonder at him, nor was I alone in this, for Ada yielded to the same fascination. As to my guardian, the wind, which had threatened to become fixed in the east when we left Somers Town, veered completely round before we were a couple of miles from it. Whether of questionable childishness or not in any other matters, Mr. Skimpole had a child's enjoyment of change and bright weather. In no way wearied by his sallies on the road, he was in the drawing-room before any of us, and I heard him at the piano while I was yet looking after my housekeeping, singing refrains of barcaroles and drinking songs, Italian and German, by the score. We were all assembled shortly before dinner, and he was still at the piano, idly picking out in his luxurious way little strains of music, and talking between whiles of finishing some sketches of the ruined old Verulam wall tomorrow, which he had begun a year or two ago and had got tired of, when a card was brought in, and my guardian read aloud in a surprised voice, "Sir Leicester Dedlock." The visitor was in the room while it was yet turning round with me, and before I had the power to stir. If I had had it, I should have hurried away. I had not even the presence of mind in my giddiness to retire to Ada in the window, or to see the window, or to know where it was. I heard my name, and found that my guardian was presenting me before I could move to a chair.
"Pray be seated, Sir Leicester."
"Mr. Jarndyce,"
said Sir Leicester in reply as he bowed and seated himself.
"I do myself the honour of calling here."
"You do me the honour, Sir Leicester."
"Thank you. Of calling here on my road from Lincolnshire to express my regret that any cause of complaint, however strong, that I may have against a gentleman who is known to you and has been your host, and to whom, therefore, I will make no further reference, should have prevented you, still more ladies under your escort and charge, from seeing whatever little there may be to gratify a polite and refined taste at my house, Chesney Wold."
"You are exceedingly obliging, Sir Leicester, and on behalf of those ladies who are present, and for myself, I thank you very much."
"It is possible, Mr. Jarndyce, that the gentleman to whom, for the reasons I have mentioned, I refrain from making further allusion, it is possible, Mr. Jarndyce, that that gentleman may have done me the honour so far to misapprehend my character as to induce you to believe that you would not have been received by my local establishment in Lincolnshire with that urbanity, that courtesy, which its members are instructed to show to all ladies and gentlemen who present themselves at that house. I merely beg to observe, sir, that the fact is the reverse."
My guardian delicately dismissed this remark, without making any verbal answer.
"It has given me pain, Mr. Jarndyce," Sir Leicester weightily proceeded. "I assure you, sir, it has given me pain to learn from the housekeeper at Chesney Wold that a gentleman who was in your company in that part of the county, and who would appear to possess a cultivated taste for the fine arts, was likewise deterred by some such cause from examining the family pictures with that leisure, that attention, that care which he might have desired to bestow upon them, and which some of them might possibly have repaid."
Here he produced a card and read, with much gravity and a little trouble, through his eyeglass,
"Mr. Harold Scampling, I beg your pardon, Skimpole."
"This is Mr. Harold Skimpole," said my guardian, evidently surprised.
"Oh," exclaimed Sir Leicester, "I'm happy to meet Mr. Skimpole, and to have the opportunity of tendering my personal regret. I hope, sir, that when you again find yourself in my part of the county, you will be under no similar sense of restraint.
You are very obliging, Sir Leicester Dedlock. So encouraged, I shall certainly give myself the pleasure and advantage of another visit to your beautiful house, the owners of such places as Chesney Wold, said Mr. Skimpole, with his usual happy and easy air, are public benefactors. They are good enough to maintain a number of delightful objects for the admiration and pleasure of us poor men, and not to reap all the admiration and pleasure that they yield is to be ungrateful to our benefactors. Sir Leicester seemed to approve of this sentiment highly.
An artist, sir?
No, replied Mr. Skimpole, a perfectly idle man, a mere amateur. Sir Leicester seemed to approve of this even more. He hoped he might have the good fortune to be at Chesney Wold when Mr. Skimpole next came down into Lincolnshire. Mr. Skimpole professed himself much flattered and honoured.
Mr. Skimpole mentioned, pursued Sir Leicester, addressing himself again to my guardian, mentioned to the housekeeper, who, as he may have observed, is an old and attached retainer of the family.
That is, when I walked through the house the other day, on the occasion of my going down to visit Miss Summerson and Miss Clare, Mr. Skimpole airily explained to us,
that the friend with whom he had formerly been staying there was Mr. Jarndyce.
Sir Leicester bowed to the bearer of that name.
And hence I became aware of the circumstance for which I have professed my regret. That this should have occurred to any gentleman, Mr. Jarndyce, but especially a gentleman formerly known to Lady Dedlock, and indeed claiming some distant connection with her, and for whom, as I learn from my lady herself, she entertains a high respect, does, I assure you, give me pain.
"Pray say no more about it, Sir Leicester," returned my guardian. "I am very sensible, as I am sure we all are, of your consideration. Indeed, the mistake was mine, and I ought to apologize for it." I had not once looked up. I had not seen the visitor, and had not even appeared to myself to hear the conversation. It surprises me to find that I can recall it, for it seemed to make no impression on me as it passed. I heard them speaking, but my mind was so confused, and my instinctive avoidance of this gentleman made his presence so distressing to me, that I thought I understood nothing, through the rushing in my head and the beating of my heart.
"I mentioned the subject to Lady Dedlock," said Sir Leicester, rising, "and my lady informed me that she had had the pleasure of exchanging a few words with Mr. Jarndyce and his wards on the occasion of an accidental meeting during their sojourn in the vicinity. Permit me, Mr. Jarndyce, to repeat to yourself and to these ladies the assurance I have already tendered to Mr. Skimpole. Circumstances undoubtedly prevent my saying that it would afford me any gratification to hear that Mr. Boythorn had favoured my house with his presence, but those circumstances are confined to that gentleman himself, and do not extend beyond him."
"You know my old opinion of him," said Mr. Skimpole, lightly appealing to us. "An amiable bull who is determined to make every colour scarlet." Sir Leicester Dedlock coughed, as if he could not possibly hear another word in reference to such an individual, and took his leave with great ceremony and politeness. I got to my own room with all possible speed, and remained there until I had recovered my self-command. It had been very much disturbed, and I was thankful to find, when I went downstairs again, that they only rallied me for having been shy and mute before the great Lincolnshire baronet. By that time I had made up my mind that the period was come when I must tell my guardian what I knew. The possibility of my being brought into contact with my mother, of my being taken to her house, even of Mr. Skimpole's, however distantly associated with me, receiving kindnesses and obligations from her husband, was so painful that I felt I could no longer guide myself without his assistance. When we had retired for the night, and Ada and I had had our usual talk in our pretty room, I went out at my door again, and sought my guardian among his books. I knew he always read at that hour, and as I drew near, I saw the light shining out into the passage from his reading lamp. "May I come in, guardian?"
"Surely, little woman. What's the matter?"
"Nothing is the matter. I thought I would like to take this quiet time of saying a word to you about myself." He put a chair for me, shut his book and put it by, and turned his kind, attentive face towards me. I could not help observing that it wore that curious expression I had observed in it once before, on that night when he had said that he was in no trouble which I could readily understand.
"What concerns you, my dear Esther?" said he. "Concerns us all. You cannot be more ready to speak than I am to hear."
"I know that, guardian.
but I have such need of your advice and support. Oh, you don't know how much need I have tonight." He looked unprepared for my being so earnest, and even a little alarmed. "Oh, how anxious I have been to speak to you," said I, "ever since the visitor was here today."
"The visitor, my dear? Sir Leicester Dedlock?"
"Yes."
He folded his arms and sat looking at me with an air of the profoundest astonishment, awaiting what I should say next. I did not know how to prepare him.
"Why, Esther," said he, breaking into a smile, "our visitor and you are the two last persons on earth I should have thought of connecting together."
"Oh, yes, guardian, I know it. And I, too, but a little while ago."
The smile passed from his face, and he became graver than before. He crossed to the door to see that it was shut, but I had seen to that, and resumed his seat before me.
"Guardian," said I, "do you remember when we were overtaken by the thunderstorm, Lady Dedlock's speaking to you of her sister?"
"Of course. Of course I do."
"And reminding you that she and her sister had differed, had gone their several ways?"
"Of course."
"Why did they separate, guardian?"
His face quite altered as he looked at me.
"My child, what questions are these? I never knew. No one but themselves ever did know, I believe. Who could tell what the secrets of those two handsome and proud women were? You have seen Lady Dedlock. If you had ever seen her sister, you would know her to have been as resolute and haughty as she."
"Oh, guardian, I have seen her many and many a time."
"Seen her?"
He paused a little, biting his lip.
"Then, Esther, when you spoke to me long ago of Boythorn, and when I told you that he was all but married once, and that the lady did not die, but died to him, and that that time had had its influence on his later life, did you know it all, and know who the lady was?"
"No, guardian,"
I returned, fearful of the light that dimly broke upon me.
"Nor do I know yet." "Lady Dedlock's sister."
"And why?" I could scarcely ask him. "Why, guardian, pray tell me, why were they parted?"
"It was her act, and she kept its motives in her inflexible heart. He afterwards did conjecture, but it was mere conjecture, that some injury which her haughty spirit had received in her cause of quarrel with her sister had wounded her beyond all reason. But she wrote him that from the date of that letter she died to him, as in literal truth she did, and that the resolution was exacted from her by her knowledge of his proud temper and his strained sense of honour, which were both her nature too. In consideration for those master points in him, and even in consideration for them in herself, she made the sacrifice, she said, and would live in it and die in it. She did both, I fear. Certainly he never saw her, never heard of her from that hour, nor did any one."
"Oh, guardian, what have I done?" I cried, giving way to my grief. "What sorrow have I innocently caused?"
"You caused, Esther?"
"Yes, guardian, innocently, but most surely. That secluded sister is my first remembrance."
"No, no,"
he cried, starting.
"Yes, guardian, yes, and her sister is my mother."
I would have told him all my mother's letter, but he would not hear it then. He spoke so tenderly and wisely to me, and he put so plainly before me all I had myself imperfectly thought and hoped in my better state of mind, that, penetrated as I had been with fervent gratitude towards him through so many years, I believed I had never loved him so dearly, never thanked him in my heart so fully as I did that night. And when he had taken me to my room and kissed me at the door, and when at last I lay down to sleep, my thought was how could I ever be busy enough, how could I ever be good enough, how in my little way could I ever hope to be forgetful enough of myself, devoted enough to him and useful enough to others, to show him how I blessed and honoured him.
Chapter 44. The Letter and the Answer.
My guardian called me into his room next morning, and then I told him what had been left untold on the previous night. There was nothing to be done, he said, but to keep the secret, and to avoid another such encounter as that of yesterday. He understood my feeling and entirely shared it. He charged himself even with restraining Mr. Skimpole from improving his opportunity. One person whom he need not name to me, it was not now possible for him to advise or help. He wished it were, but no such thing could be. If her mistrust of the lawyer whom she had mentioned were well-founded, which he scarcely doubted, he dreaded discovery. He knew something of him, both by sight and by reputation, and it was certain that he was a dangerous man. Whatever happened, he repeatedly impressed upon me with anxious affection and kindness, I was as innocent of as himself, and as unable to influence.
"Nor do I understand," said he, "that any doubts tend towards you, my dear. Much suspicion may exist without that connection."
"With the lawyer," I returned, "but two other persons have come into my mind since I have been anxious." Then I told him all about Mr. Guppy, who I feared might have had his vague surmises when I little understood his meaning, but in whose silence, after our last interview, I expressed perfect confidence.
"Well," said my guardian, "then we may dismiss him for the present. Who is the other?"
I recalled to his recollection the French maid and the eager offer of herself she had made to me.
"Ah," he returned thoughtfully, "that is a more alarming person than the clerk. But after all, my dear, it was but seeking for a new service. She had seen you and Ada a little while before, and it was natural that you should come into her head. She merely proposed herself for your maid, you know. She did nothing more."
"Her manner was strange," said I.
"Yes, and her manner was strange when she took her shoes off and showed that cool relish for a walk that might have ended in her deathbed," said my guardian. "It would be useless self-distress and torment to reckon up such chances and possibilities. There are very few harmless circumstances that would not seem full of perilous meaning, so considered. Be hopeful, little woman. You can be nothing better than yourself, be that, through this knowledge, as you were before you had it. It is the best you can do for everybody's sake. I, sharing the secret with you—"
"And lightening it, guardian, so much," said I,
"will be attentive to what passes in that family, so far as I can observe it from my distance. And if the time should come when I can stretch out a hand to render the least service to one whom it is better not to name even here, I will not fail to do it for her dear daughter's sake."
I thanked him with my whole heart. What could I ever do but thank him? I was going out at the door when he asked me to stay a moment. Quickly turning round, I saw that same expression on his face again, and all at once, I don't know how, it flashed upon me as a new and far-off possibility that I understood it.
"My dear Esther," said my guardian, "I have long had something in my thoughts that I have wished to say to you."
"Indeed?"
"I have had some difficulty in approaching it, and I still have. I should wish it to be so deliberately said and so deliberately considered. Would you object to my writing it?"
"Dear guardian, how could I object to your writing anything for me to read?"
"Then see, my love," said he with his cheery smile, "am I, at this moment, quite as plain and easy? Do I seem as open, as honest, and old-fashioned, as I am at any time?"
I answered with all earnestness, "Quite."
With the strictest truth, for his momentary hesitation was gone, it had not lasted a minute, and his fine, sensible, cordial, sterling manner was restored. "Do I look as if I suppressed anything, meant anything but what I said, had any reservation at all, no matter what?"
said he, with his bright, clear eyes on mine. I answered most assuredly he did not.
"Can you fully trust me and thoroughly rely on what I profess, Esther?"
"Most thoroughly," said I, with my whole heart.
"My dear girl," returned my guardian, "give me your hand."
He took it in his, holding me lightly with his arm, and looking down into my face with the same genuine freshness and faithfulness of manner, the old protecting manner which had made that house my home in a moment, said,
"You have wrought changes in me, little woman, since the winter day in the stage-coach. First and last you have done me a world of good since that time."
"Ah, guardian, what have you done for me since that time?"
"But," said he, "that is not to be remembered now."
"It can never be forgotten."
"Yes, Esther," said he with a gentle seriousness, "it is to be forgotten now. To be forgotten for a while. You are only to remember now that nothing can change me as you know me. Can you feel quite assured of that, my dear?"
"I can, and I do," I said.
"That's much," he answered. "That's everything. But I must not take that at a word. I will not write this something in my thoughts until you have quite resolved within yourself that nothing can change me as you know me. If you doubt that in the least degree, I will never write it. If you are sure of that, on good consideration, send Charlie to me this night week for the letter. But if you are not quite certain, never send. Mind, I trust to your truth in this thing as in everything. If you are not quite certain on that one point, never send.
Guardian, said I am already certain. I can no more be changed in that conviction than you can be changed towards me. I shall send Charlie for the letter. He shook my hand and said no more. Nor was any more said in reference to this conversation, either by him or me, through the whole week. When the appointed night came, I said to Charlie, as soon as I was alone, "Go and knock at Mr. Jarndyce's door, Charlie, and say you've come from me for the letter." Charlie went up the stairs and down the stairs and along the passages. The zigzag way about the old-fashioned house seemed very long in my listening ears that night, and so came back along the passages and down the stairs and up the stairs and brought the letter. "Lay it on the table, Charlie," said I. So Charlie laid it on the table and went to bed, and I sat looking at it without taking it up, thinking of many things. I began with my overshadowed childhood and passed through those timid days to the heavy time when my aunt lay dead, with her resolute face so cold and set, and when I was more solitary with Mrs. Rachel than if I had had no one in the world to speak to or to look at. I passed to the altered days when I was so blessed as to find friends in all around me, and to be beloved. I came to the time when I first saw my dear girl, and was received into that sisterly affection which was the grace and beauty of my life. I recalled the first bright gleam of welcome which had shone out of those very windows upon our expectant faces on that cold, bright night, and which had never paled. I lived my happy life there over again. I went through my illness and recovery. I thought of myself so altered, and of those around me so unchanged. And all this happiness shone like a light from one central figure, represented before me by the letter on the table. I opened it and read it. It was so impressive in its love for me, and in the unselfish caution it gave me, and the consideration it showed for me in every word, that my eyes were too often blinded to read much at a time. But I read it through 3 times before I laid it down. I had thought beforehand that I knew its purport, and I did. It asked me, would I be the mistress of Bleak House? It was not a love letter, though it expressed so much love, but was written just as he would at any time have spoken to me. I saw his face and heard his voice, and felt the influence of his kind, protecting manner in every line. It addressed me as if our places were reversed, as if all the good deeds had been mine, and all the feelings they had awakened his. It dwelt on my being young, and he past the prime of life, on his having attained a ripe age, while I was a child, on his writing to me with a silvered head, and knowing all this so well as to set it in full before me for mature deliberation. It told me that I would gain nothing by such a marriage, and lose nothing by rejecting it, for no new relation could enhance the tenderness in which he held me, and whatever my decision was, he was certain it would be right. But he had considered this step anew since our late confidence, and had decided on taking it, if it only served to show me through one poor instance that the whole world would readily unite to falsify the stern prediction of my childhood. I was the last to know what happiness I could bestow upon him, but of that he said no more, for I was always to remember that I owed him nothing, and that he was my debtor, and for very much. He had often thought of our future, and foreseeing that the time must come, and fearing that it might come soon, when Ada, now very nearly of age, would leave us, and when our present mode of life must be broken up, had become accustomed to reflect on this proposal. Thus he made it. If I felt that I could ever give him the best right he could have to be my protector, and if I felt that I could happily and justly become the dear companion of his remaining life, superior to all lighter chances and changes than death, even then he could not have me bind myself irrevocably while this letter was yet so new to me. But even then I must have ample time for reconsideration. In that case, or in the opposite case, let him be unchanged in his old relation, in his old manner, in the old name by which I called him. And as to his bright Dame Durden and little housekeeper, she would ever be the same, he knew.
This was the substance of the letter, written throughout with a justice and a dignity as if he were indeed my responsible guardian, impartially representing the proposal of a friend against whom, in his integrity, he stated the full case. But he did not hint to me that when I had been better looking he had had this same proceeding in his thoughts and had refrained from it. That when my old face was gone from me and I had no attractions, he could love me just as well as in my fairer days. That the discovery of my birth gave him no shock. That his generosity rose above my disfigurement and my inheritance of shame. That the more I stood in need of such fidelity, the more firmly I might trust in him to the last. But I knew it. I knew it well now. It came upon me as the close of the benignant history I had been pursuing, and I felt that I had but one thing to do. To devote my life to his happiness was to thank him poorly. And what had I wished for the other night but some new means of thanking him? Still I cried very much. Not only in the fullness of my heart after reading the letter, not only in the strangeness of the prospect, for it was strange, though I had expected the contents, but as if something for which there was no name or distinct idea were indefinitely lost to me. I was very happy, very thankful, very hopeful, but I cried very much. By and by I went to my old glass. My eyes were red and swollen, and I said, "Oh, Esther, Esther, can that be you?" I am afraid the face in the glass was going to cry again at this reproach, but I held up my finger at it, and it stopped. "That is more like the composed look you comforted me with, my dear, when you showed me such a change," said I, beginning to let down my hair. "When you are mistress of Bleak House, you are to be as cheerful as a bird. In fact, you are always to be cheerful, so let us begin for once and for all." I went on with my hair now quite comfortably. I sobbed a little still, but that was because I had been crying, not because I was crying then. "And so, Esther, my dear, you are happy for life, happy with your best friends, happy in your old home, happy in the power of doing a great deal of good, and happy in the undeserved love of the best of men." I thought all at once, if my guardian had married someone else, how should I have felt, and what should I have done? That would have been a change indeed. It presented my life in such a new and blank form that I rang my housekeeping keys and gave them a kiss before I laid them down in their basket again. Then I went on to think, as I dressed my hair before the glass, how often had I considered within myself that the deep traces of my illness and the circumstances of my birth were only new reasons why I should be busy, 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 useful, amiable, serviceable, in all honest, unpretending ways. This was a good time, to be sure, to sit down morbidly and cry. As to its seeming at all strange to me at first, if that were any excuse for crying, which it was not, that I was one day to be the mistress of Bleak House, why should it seem strange? Other people had thought of such things, if I had not. "Don't you remember, my plain dear," I asked myself, looking at the glass, "what Mrs. Woodcourt said before those scars were there about your marrying?" Perhaps the name brought them to my remembrance. The dried remains of the flowers. It would be better not to keep them now. They had only been preserved in memory of something wholly past and gone, and it would be better not to keep them now. They were in a book, and it happened to be in the next room, our sitting-room, dividing Ada's chamber from mine. I took a candle and went softly in to fetch it from its shelf. After I had it in my hand, I saw my beautiful darling through the open door, lying asleep, and I stole in to kiss her. It was weak in me, I know, and I could have no reason for crying, but I dropped a tear upon her dear face, and another. Weaker than that, I took the withered flowers out and put them for a moment to her lips. I thought about her love for Richard, though indeed the flowers had nothing to do with that. Then I took them into my own room and burned them at the candle, and they were dust in an instant. On entering the breakfast room next morning, I found my guardian just as usual, quite as frank, as open and free, there being not the least constraint in his manner. There was none, or I think there was none, in mine. I was with him several times in the course of the morning, in and out, when there was no one there, and I thought it not unlikely that he might speak to me about the letter, but he did not say a word. So on the next morning, and the next, and for at least a week, over which time Mr. Skimpole prolonged his stay, I expected every day that my guardian might speak to me about the letter. But he never did. I thought then, growing uneasy, that I ought to write an answer. I tried over and over again in my own room at night, but I could not write an answer that at all began like a good answer. So I thought each night I would wait one more day. And I waited 7 more days, and he never said a word. At last, Mr. Skimpole having departed, we three were one afternoon going out for a ride, and I, being dressed before Ada and going down, came upon my guardian, with his back towards me, standing at the drawing-room window looking out. He turned on my coming in and said, smiling, "Ah, it's you, little woman, is it?" and looked out again. I had made up my mind to speak to him now. In short, I had come down on purpose. "Guardian," I said, rather hesitating and trembling, "when would you like to have the answer to the letter Charlie came for?"
"When it's ready, my dear," he replied.
"I think it is ready," said I.
"Is Charlie to bring it?" he asked pleasantly.
"No. I have brought it myself, guardian," I returned. I put my two arms round his neck and kissed him, and he said, was this the mistress of Bleak House? And I said yes, and it made no difference presently, and we all went out together, and I said nothing to my precious pet about it. Chapter 45. In Trust. One morning, when I had done jingling about with my basket of keys, as my beauty and I were walking round and round the garden, I happened to turn my eyes towards the house, and saw a long, thin shadow going in which looked like Mr. Vholes. Ada had been telling me only that morning of her hopes that Richard might exhaust his ardour in the Chancery suit by being so very earnest in it, and therefore, not to damp my dear girl's spirits, I said nothing about Mr. Vholes's shadow. Presently came Charlie, lightly winding among the bushes and tripping along the paths, as rosy and pretty as one of Flora's attendants instead of my maid, saying,
"Oh, if you please, miss, would you step and speak to Mr. Jarndyce?"
It was one of Charlie's peculiarities that whenever she was charged with a message, she always began to deliver it as soon as she beheld at any distance the person for whom it was intended. Therefore I saw Charlie asking me in her usual form of words to step and speak to Mr. Jarndyce long before I heard her. And when I did hear her, she had said it so often that she was out of breath. I told Ada I would make haste back and inquired of Charlie as we went in whether there was not a gentleman with Mr. Jarndyce, to which Charlie, whose grammar, I confess to my shame, never did any credit to my educational powers, replied,
"Yes, miss, him has come down in the country with Mr. Richard."
A more complete contrast than my guardian and Mr. Vholes, I suppose there could not be. I found them looking at one another across a table, the one so open and the other so close, the one so broad and upright and the other so narrow and stooping, the one giving out what he had to say in such a rich, ringing voice, and the other keeping it in such a cold-blooded, gasping, fish-like manner, that I thought I never had seen two people so unmatched.
"You know, Mr. Vholes, my dear," said my guardian,
not with the greatest urbanity, I must say. Mr. Vholes rose, gloved and buttoned up as usual, and seated himself again, just as he had seated himself beside Richard in the gig. Not having Richard to look at, he looked straight before him.
"Mr. Vholes," said my guardian,
eyeing his black figure as if he were a bird of ill omen,
"has brought an ugly report of our most unfortunate Rick,"
laying a marked emphasis on "most unfortunate," as if the words were rather descriptive of his connection with Mr. Vholes. I sat down between them. Mr. Vholes remained immovable, except that he secretly picked at one of the red pimples on his yellow face with his black glove.
"And as Rick and you are happily good friends, I should like to know," said my guardian, "what you think, my dear. Would you be so good as to speak up, Mr. Vholes?"
Doing anything but that, Mr. Vholes observed,
"I have been saying that I have reason to know, Miss Summerson, as Mr. C.'s professional adviser, that Mr. C.'s circumstances are at the present moment in an embarrassed state, not so much in point of amount as owing to the peculiar and pressing nature of liabilities Mr. C. has incurred, and the means he has of liquidating or meeting the same. I have staved off many little matters for Mr. C., but there is a limit to staving off, and we have reached it. I have made some advances out of pocket to accommodate these unpleasantnesses, but I necessarily look to being repaid, for I do not pretend to be a man of capital, and I have a father to support in the Vale of Taunton, besides striving to realize some little independence for 3 dear girls at home. My apprehension is Mr. C.'s circumstances being such lest it should end in his obtaining leave to part with his commission, which at all events is desirable to be made known to his connections. Mr. Vholes, who had looked at me while speaking, here emerged into the silence he could hardly be said to have broken, so stifled was his tone, and looked before him again.
"Imagine the poor fellow without even his present resource," said my guardian to me. "Yet what can I do? You know him, Esther. He would never accept of help from me now. To offer it, or hint at it, would be to drive him to an extremity if nothing else did."
Mr. Vholes hereupon addressed me again. "What Mr. Jarndyce remarks, miss, is no doubt the case, and is the difficulty. I do not see that anything is to be done. I do not say that anything is to be done, far from it. I merely come down here under the seal of confidence, and mention it, in order that everything may be openly carried on, and that it may not be said afterwards that everything was not openly carried on. My wish is that everything should be openly carried on. I desire to leave a good name behind me. If I consulted merely my own interests with Mr. C., I should not be here. So insurmountable, as you must well know, would be his objections. This is not a professional attendance. This can be charged to nobody. I have no interest in it, except as a member of society and a father, and a son," said Mr. Vholes, who had nearly forgotten that point. It appeared to us that Mr. Vholes said neither more nor less than the truth in intimating that he sought to divide the responsibility, such as it was, of knowing Richard's situation. I could only suggest that I should go down to Deal, where Richard was then stationed, and see him, and try if it were possible to avert the worst. Without consulting Mr. Vholes on this point, I took my guardian aside to propose it, while Mr. Vholes gauntly stalked to the fire and warmed his funeral gloves. The fatigue of the journey formed an immediate objection on my guardian's part, but as I saw he had no other, and as I was only too happy to go, I got his consent. We had then merely to dispose of Mr. Vholes.
"Well, sir," said Mr. Jarndyce, "Miss Summerson will communicate with Mr. Carstone, and you can only hope that his position may be yet retrievable. You will allow me to order you lunch after your journey, sir?"
"I thank you, Mr. Jarndyce," said Mr. Vholes, putting out his long black sleeve to check the ringing of the bell. "Not any, I thank you, no, not a morsel. My digestion is much impaired, and I am but a poor knife and fork at any time. If I was to partake of solid food at this period of the day, I don't know what the consequences might be. Everything having been openly carried on, sir, I will now, with your permission, take my leave."
"And I would that you could take your leave, and we could all take our leave, Mr. Vholes," returned my guardian bitterly, "of a cause you know of."
Mr. Vholes, whose black dye was so deep from head to foot that it had quite steamed before the fire, diffusing a very unpleasant perfume, made a short one-sided inclination of his head from the neck and slowly shook it. "We whose ambition it is to be looked upon in the light of respectable practitioners, sir, can but put our shoulders to the wheel. We do it, sir. At least I do it myself, and I wish to think well of my professional brethren, one and all. You are sensible of an obligation not to refer to me, miss, in communicating with Mr. C.?"
I said I would be careful not to do it.
"Just so, miss. Good morning, Mr. Jarndyce. Good morning, sir." Mr. Vholes put his dead glove, which scarcely seemed to have any hand in it, on my fingers, and then on my guardian's fingers, and took his long, thin shadow away. I thought of it on the outside of the coach, passing over all the sunny landscape between us and London, chilling the seed in the ground as it glided along. Of course, it became necessary to tell Ada where I was going, and why I was going, and of course she was anxious and distressed. But she was too true to Richard to say anything but words of pity and words of excuse, and in a more loving spirit still, my dear devoted girl, she wrote him a long letter of which I took charge. Charlie was to be my travelling companion, though I am sure I wanted none, and would willingly have left her at home. We all went to London that afternoon, and finding two places in the mail, secured them. At our usual bedtime, Charlie and I were rolling away seaward with the Kentish letters. It was a night's journey in those coach times, but we had the mail to ourselves, and did not find the night very tedious. It passed with me as I suppose it would with most people under such circumstances. At one, while my journey looked hopeful, and at another, hopeless. Now I thought I should do some good, and now I wondered how I could ever have supposed so. Now it seemed one of the most reasonable things in the world that I should have come, and now one of the most unreasonable. In what state I should find Richard,
What I should say to him, and what he would say to me, occupied my mind by turns with these two states of feeling, and the wheels seemed to play one tune to which the burden of my guardian's letter set itself, over and over again all night. At last we came into the narrow streets of Deal, and very gloomy they were upon a raw, misty morning. The long, flat beach, with its little irregular houses, wooden and brick, and its litter of capstans, and great boats and sheds, and bare upright poles with tackle and blocks, and loose, gravelly waste places overgrown with grass and weeds, wore as dull an appearance as any place I ever saw. The sea was heaving under a thick white fog, and nothing else was moving but a few early rope-makers, who, with the yarn twisted round their bodies, looked as if, tired of their present state of existence, they were spinning themselves into cordage. But when we got into a warm room, in an excellent hotel, and sat down, comfortably washed and dressed, to an early breakfast, for it was too late to think of going to bed, Deal began to look more cheerful. Our little room was like a ship's cabin, and that delighted Charlie very much. Then the fog began to rise like a curtain, and numbers of ships that we had had no idea were near appeared. I don't know how many sail, the waiter told us, were then lying in the Downs. Some of these vessels were of grand size. One was a large Indiaman, just come home. And when the sun shone through the clouds, making silvery pools in the dark sea, the way in which these ships brightened and shadowed and changed, amid a bustle of boats pulling off from the shore to them, and from them to the shore, and a general life and motion in themselves and everything around them, was most beautiful. The large Indiaman was our great attraction, because she had come into the Downs in the night. She was surrounded by boats, and we said how glad the people on board of her must be to come ashore. Charlie was curious, too, about the voyage, and about the heat in India, and the serpents and the tigers. And as she picked up such information much faster than grammar, I told her what I knew on those points. I told her, too, how people in such voyages were sometimes wrecked and cast on rocks, where they were saved by the intrepidity and humanity of one man. And Charlie asked how that could be. I told her how we knew at home of such a case. I had thought of sending Richard a note saying I was there, but it seemed so much better to go to him without preparation. As he lived in barracks, I was a little doubtful whether this was feasible, but we went out to reconnoitre. Peeping in at the gate of the barrack yard, we found everything very quiet at that time in the morning, and I asked a sergeant standing on the guardhouse steps where he lived. He sent a man before to show me, who went up some bare stairs and knocked with his knuckles at a door and left us. "Now then," cried Richard from within. So I left Charlie in the little passage, and going on to the half-open door said, "Can I come in, Richard? It's only Dame Durden." He was writing at a table, with a great confusion of clothes, tin cases, books, boots, brushes, and portmanteaus strewn all about the floor. He was only half-dressed, in plain clothes, I observed, not in uniform, and his hair was unbrushed, and he looked as wild as his room. All this I saw after he had heartily welcomed me, and I was seated near him, for he started upon hearing my voice, and caught me in his arms in a moment. Dear Richard, he was ever the same to me, down to, poor fellow, to the end. He never received me, but with something of his old merry boyish manner. "Good heaven, my dear little woman," said he, "how do you come here? Who could have thought of seeing you? Nothing the matter? Ada is well?" "Quite well. Lovelier than ever, Richard." "Ah!" he said, leaning back in his chair. "My poor cousin, I was writing to you, Esther." So worn and haggard as he looked, even in the fullness of his handsome youth, leaning back in his chair and crushing the closely written sheet of paper in his hand. "Have you been at the trouble of writing all that, and am I not to read it after all?" I asked. "Oh, my dear," he returned with a hopeless gesture, "you may read it in the whole room. It is all over here." I mildly entreated him not to be despondent. I told him that I had heard by chance of his being in difficulty, and had come to consult with him what could best be done. "Like you, Esther, but useless, and so not like you," said he with a melancholy smile. "I am away on leave this day, should have been gone in another hour, and that is to smooth it over for my selling out. Well, let bygones be bygones. So this calling follows the rest. I only want to have been in the church to have made the round of all the professions." "Richard," I urged, "it is not so hopeless as that." "Esther," he returned, "it is indeed. I am just so near disgrace as that those who are put in authority over me, as the catechism goes, would far rather be without me than with me. And they are right. Apart from debts and duns and all such drawbacks, I am not fit even for this employment. I have no care, no mind, no heart, no soul, but for one thing. Why, if this bubble hadn't broken now, he said, tearing the letter he had written into fragments and moodily casting them away by driblets, how could I have gone abroad? I must have been ordered abroad, but how could I have gone? How could I, with my experience of that thing, trust even Vholes unless I was at his back? I suppose he knew by my face what I was about to say. But he caught the hand I had laid upon his arm, and touched my own lips with it, to prevent me from going on. No, Dame Durden, two subjects I forbid, must forbid. The first is John Jarndyce, the second, you know what. Call it madness, and I tell you I can't help it now, and can't be sane. But it is no such thing. It is the one object I have to pursue. It is a pity I ever was prevailed upon to turn out of my road for any other. It would be wisdom to abandon it now, after all the time, anxiety, and pains I have bestowed upon it. Oh, yes, true wisdom. It would be very agreeable, too, to some people. But I never will. He was in that mood in which I thought it best not to increase his determination, if anything could increase it, by opposing him. I took out Ada's letter, and put it in his hand. "Am I to read it now?" he asked. As I told him yes, he laid it on the table, and resting his head upon his hand, began. He had not read far when he rested his hand upon his two hands, to hide his face from me. In a little while he rose, as if the light were bad, and went to the window. He finished reading it there with his back towards me, and after he had finished and had folded it up, stood there for some minutes with the letter in his hand. When he came back to his chair, I saw tears in his eyes. "Of course, Esther, you know what she says here." He spoke in a softened voice and kissed the letter as he asked me. "Yes, Richard." "Offers me," he went on, tapping his foot upon the floor, "the little inheritance she is certain of so soon, just as little and as much as I have wasted, and begs and prays me to take it, set myself right with it, and remain in the service." "I know your welfare to be the dearest wish of her heart," said I. "And oh, my dear Richard, Ada's is a noble heart." "I am sure it is. I wish I was dead." He went back to the window, and laying his arm across it, leaned his head down on his arm. It greatly affected me to see him so, but I hoped he might become more yielding, and I remained silent. My experience was very limited. I was not at all prepared for his rousing himself out of this emotion to a new sense of injury. And this is the heart that the same John Jarndyce, who is not otherwise to be mentioned between us, stepped in to estrange from me, said he indignantly, and the dear girl makes me this generous offer from under the same John Jarndyce's roof, and with the same John Jarndyce's gracious consent and connivance, I dare say, as a new means of buying me off. "Richard," I cried out, rising hastily, "I will not hear you say such shameful words." I was very angry with him indeed, for the first time in my life, but it only lasted a moment. When I saw his worn young face looking at me as if he were sorry, I put my hand on his shoulder and said, "If you please, my dear Richard, do not speak in such a tone to me. Consider." He blamed himself exceedingly, and told me in the most generous manner that he had been very wrong, and that he begged my pardon 1,000 times. At that I laughed, but trembled a little too, for I was rather fluttered after being so fiery. "To accept this offer, my dear Esther," said he, sitting down beside me and resuming our conversation, "once more, pray forgive me. I am deeply grieved. To accept my dearest cousin's offer is, I need not say, impossible. Besides, I have letters and papers that I could show you which would convince you it is all over here. I have done with the red coat, believe me. But it is some satisfaction in the midst of my troubles and perplexities to know that I am pressing Ada's interests in pressing my own. Vholes has his shoulder to the wheel, and he cannot help urging it on as much for her as for me, thank God." His sanguine hopes were rising within him and lighting up his features, but they made his face more sad to me than it had been before. "No, no," cried Richard exultingly. "If every farthing of Ada's little fortune were mine, no part of it should be spent in retaining me in what I am not fit for, can take no interest in, and am weary of. It should be devoted to what promises a better return, and should be used where she has a larger stake. Don't be uneasy for me. I shall now have only one thing on my mind, and Vholes and I will work it. I shall not be without means. Free of my commission, I shall be able to compound with some small usurers who will hear of nothing but their bond now. Vholes says so. I should have a balance in my favour anyway, but that would swell it. Come, come. You shall carry a letter to Ada from me, Esther, and you must both of you be more hopeful of me and not believe that I am quite cast away just yet, my dear. I will not repeat what I said to Richard. I know it was tiresome, and nobody is to suppose for a moment that it was at all wise. It only came from my heart. He heard it patiently and feelingly, but I saw that on the two subjects he had reserved it was at present hopeless to make any representation to him. I saw, too, and had experienced in this very interview, the sense of my guardian's remark that it was even more mischievous to use persuasion with him than to leave him as he was. Therefore I was driven at last to asking Richard if he would mind convincing me that it really was all over there, as he had said, and that it was not his mere impression. He showed me without hesitation